Welcome to the latest episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great stuff. This is a cultural podcast, sure, aren't they all? Let's start off talking about books. You had an interesting purchase recently. I was there when you purchased it in a bookshop called, what's it called actually?
Pasajes.
That's a very nice multilingual bookshop in near the center of Madrid. And now this book is by one of our favorite writers, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. But it's a book he didn't finish. It's a book that was left unfinished because of his untimely death, dealing with things like Alzheimer's and his son's publisher. So it already came, you know, packaged in a lot of excitement. Wow. Vaya, they say in Spanish. Wow, a new Marquez book. And also, they said, how can they publish that? There's controversy here. He didn't want to be published. But you said in a conversation with me that he only changed his mind about publishing it very close to his death. So he actually had the intention originally of publishing it. Lots of stuff going on here, but this is kind of a very dramatic, radical start to the podcast. But here we are in the middle of it. Can you tell me about your thoughts about the book and all that controversy around it and the book? Go on.
Go on. So when it first came out, like I think it was March or something like that, maybe. I did read about how, you know, he actually said, you know, he told them not to publish it. He didn't want it out and it was awful or something. Which, to be honest, is a normal reaction as well for like people that have, you know, Alzheimer's, dementia, things like that. Like, they get really frustrated as well. Yeah, that's normal. And then I'm not that keen on, you know, if somebody has said they don't want to publish it, then I don't think like the heirs should do whatever they want. But then, as a matter of fact, when I put it on my list, because it's been a few months, then I forgot, and then you reminded me, and made me feel really bad. So then I was slightly traumatized, and then very relieved to hear that, as the epilogue, that the editor that presents this book was explaining how García Márquez had been working with him on this version, and this was like what he'd marked as the final version. And he'd been editing, you know, backwards and forwards with him and like his secretary for a couple of years anyway. And even he'd been working on this before his latest book as well, that he'd published before this one. So, you know, it wasn't like a last minute thing. He'd been working on it for long. And even like the first, it's a very, very short book. But even the first chapter he read in Madrid, apparently in a meeting that he came over as a short story, really. So, I mean, the fact that he was reading, for example, that as a short story surely gives an indication that he wasn't, you know, and this was before he was more poorly. So I guess it gives an indication that at the very least he was okay with it. At some point he thought he might publish it.
Excellent. Well, I mean, obviously, you talk about Alzheimer's, which Agatha Christie, I believe, had, and it's present in the last book she wrote, also her character suffering from it. So there are these elements that are bigger than the book, such as this Alzheimer's, such as the stuff surrounding its publication. But the most important thing is it actually a good book? Is it up there with the other Marquez books?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's up there. I don't think anybody expects that it would have been up there. Even in the introduction, they say, oh, well, it's clearly, like the son say, well, it's clearly not up to his standards, but we still thought it was something valuable, and there's like glimpses here and there. And I'm not necessarily comfortable with the idea of saying, you know, of somebody judging, especially his sons, I guess, but somebody judging, well, it's not up to like his standards or whatever, when he's been an exceptional writer. I don't think like many people can judge it like that. But then, you know, in my humble opinion, I would be inclined to agree, because there are things there are like touches of genius and things that remind you of other books in that. To me, what interests me is that he always offers a perspective that I haven't really thought of. And then there's always that touch of almost, magical, you know. Obviously, he was like famous for magic realism. And there's always like that touch of like surrealism, but that is very human and believable. So those things are there. But in the story itself, it kind of like it's lost or diluted, and it comes back again. It kind of like drops off as if he was like losing trail a bit, which would make sense.
Well, I guess what we're dealing with here is also you always have the writer as an institution. And as I mentioned earlier, we are both fans of Marquez. We're not alone in that, of course. But, you know, every writer has uneven work.
Well, that's why I'm uncomfortable with somebody saying, oh, it's not up to his standard or whatever, because...
Because it's not... All of his previous work is up to this imagined standard, right?
Exactly. And it's an unreal thing, you know. You cannot say, some of them might have been, it's like any writer, you know, they might get the Nobel Prize, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's universally his best novel. You know, obviously that's subjective, but there's always some people that are going to appreciate some more than others, I would have thought.
I think a lot of writers get to a certain established state in their life, you know. Like Hunter S. Thompson, towards the end of his life, was just pumping out, well, not pumping out, it's the opposite of that, just every so often submitting an article to whatever magazine it was, Rolling Stone or whatever. And the point is that they just live off their earlier good work, and have a semi-retirement / dotage. But people always just imagine the highs and constantly attribute that to the writer. So yeah, I guess I can understand where you're coming from, that it is subjective, of course, but also it's unfair to kind of hold it up to what is essentially an imagined standard. Very interesting origin story for Marquez. What was his first book? You obviously know the title.
Well, I couldn't tell you exactly the first book what it was in terms of date. Well, obviously the most famous one by far is Cien Años de Soledad, like 100 Years of Solitude. But one that was very, and it's an early work that was for me very significant and probably one of the ones that really impressed me was... La Crónica de una Muerte Anunciada, which I think is...
Chronicle of a Death Foretold.
Yeah, I think that's... so that, I was really, really impressed by that. That's kind of like the first one that... Although I read 100 Years of Solitude, that was the one that narratively impressed me the most.
Well, regardless of what the first novel was, he was driving his car with his family on holiday. And we are in July now, the holiday season. And he stopped the car. He's like, you continue. I have to go back and write this book. He obviously had this flash of inspiration, or it was in his mind, and suddenly he just said, okay, I have to do this. And he wrote whatever that book was, and that set him up for the career that he eventually had, of course.
For me, that's the most important thing. That is, I think you mentioned in the past that you didn't find it quite as striking as me, or it didn't impress you so much. I think, well, obviously the translation could be a thing, but I think within the time, for example, this one of the Foretold, it was really, like, narratively, it was a device of, like, telling the story backwards telling the story, like, is predetermined until it exactly happens, what you already know happens, which is the death. I thought narratively was incredible. It was really well done. Perhaps now it's something more common or more seen, but I think at the time it was very, very innovative.
Okay, fair enough. So you finished it. It's a very short novel.
Very short.
Because you didn't finish it. That's why it's short.
It's weird because, like, he had it marked as final version, whether it was because, you know, final version as in this is the one I'm finishing, it kind of like there's an end to it in the book, To me, is just sort of like missing the bit that leads to the end, because it kind of like ends okay, roundly. It's not that it doesn't have an end. It does have an end, but it's kind of like it's going, and then suddenly sort of gets a bit contradictory and gets a bit fuzzy, and then it has an end that makes sense, but it's sort of like abrupt in a way, I would say. So for me, I think it was not finished in the sense that there's stuff missing there. It's almost like when you run out, like in an exam, and run out of time, and then you're like, well, I'll just say a very nice sentence.
Okay, well, that's Marketh. I think what's interesting about him is that I think he's just one collection of short stories, and short stories have been on our mind a little bit, because in our last launch of El Secreto de Rey, Laurie Lynch, a former Irish ambassador, spoke to us about how short stories have gone out of fashion. And I was thinking that a lot of books I've read recently are short story collections, but they are older. So you have obviously Yukio Mishima, Japanese writer who I've been reading a lot over since Easter, and I've started one of his books today as well, Life for Sale. And there is a collection of short stories. This is a novel, but essentially it's a lot of short stories connected together, like very specific passages. So he's a writer I would definitely recommend. But we're not going to talk about Mishima now, I guess, because, well, you do know Mishima. I've spoken to you about him before, actually. So maybe we could divert into him very briefly. Because, okay. Yeah, okay, we'll do that then.
Go ahead.
He's an interesting character because he was a writer whose books are incredibly modern, which is funny because the book I'm reading now has been influenced by manga comics, which, you know, is not modern or not modern. It is what it is. I don't know. But I get a very sense like of Japan in the 60s being very Western focused. Maybe that's the wrong impression, but it seems to be very current with very Hollywood style books, and that's a compliment, definitely. But he's an interesting character because he felt that being too intellectual was not a good thing, and he became a bodybuilder to train the body as well as the mind, and he eventually organized a coup which failed, and he performed ritual suicide as well. So yeah, so definitely a different type of writer. But no, I wanted to talk to you about Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, whatever it's called. How would you pronounce it? You're half French.
Exupéry. Saint-Exupéry. Well, I'm not an expert, but yeah, it's just Saint-Exupéry. It's Saint-Exupéry.
Well, thank you very much for that pronunciation lesson. So, well, he's famous for writing The Little Prince. What is your relationship with The Little Prince? It's a book that is universally popular.
Yeah, in Spain it's really popular. I guess it's like a reference work for us in Spain. But then a few years ago there was a big thing about him not being such a nice guy and kind of like, you know, mistreating his wife and all this and like his children. And so I have like this recent memory of reading. I can't remember if it was because I don't know if it was his diaries or her diaries or some documents that kind of show that for how sweet the little prince was and the story was and so tender, then the actual relationship and the way he treated people wasn't very nice.
Well, in The Little Prince there is this tormented love affair with a selfish female representation, notice this princess or something, which does reflect his tortured relationship with his wife. So I don't know the ins and outs of, you know, who's right or who's wrong in that relationship. All I know is that because I haven't studied him so much per se, but like he's a guy who only really felt comfortable in the sky and felt very difficult to have relationships with people. Very needy by all accounts. He would write long letters to his mother and want her reassurance, and if he wrote something new he'd demand his friends listen to him reading several pages of that. So And in fact, that was probably his undoing in the end, because he begged to be, because he was principally a pilot, which is also the basis of The Little Prince, and he begged the allies to let him fly in World War II, and he went off the path so he could fly over France. So I think by not following protocol and just kind of indulging this sense of nostalgia and this kind of sensitivity in his soul towards wanting to capture something from his past, and whatever emotion it was, he was presumably shot down by a German fighter over the Atlantic and disappeared. Nobody knows whatever happened to him, but one day, which is very much in keeping with the history of early aviation, not so much in the 40s, but when he started in the 20s and 30s, of just going up in the air and not coming back, and not only not coming back, but just disappearing without a trace. So I do know he had very complex romantic relationships. He's a troubled man in many ways, but I believe you also studied the prince, Little Prince, at school. Is this correct or no?
I'm not entirely sure at school, but it was just a typical book that you had at home, and it's not very long, so we just tended to. I'm not entirely sure whether at school we did in depth, but obviously I knew the story, and then it became very popular with the internet and all that, you know, all the quotes and the drawings.
Which he did himself also.
Like, you know, there's the snake and the hat and all this.
And the fox.
And the fox, yes. Fox was cute.
Well, the thing is, I guess we can, there's so much to his life, but the reason he wrote this is because he was shot down, well, not shot down, he crash landed in the Libyan desert, and he did see foxes there, and he kind of followed their tracks and all these different things, and obviously this left an impression on him, and then this boy being stranded from his home planet, and having a fox as an ally, is directly linked to his experiences, in being shot down over the Libyan desert. And for me, it was very interesting to see this kind of universal story that's written for children, but also adults love it. It was underscored and influenced and inspired by this kind of past, this moments in the early days of aviation and being trapped in the desert. I mean, I guess in Spain, you are so familiar with the story, you already knew this.
I'm not sure I necessarily remember that I crashed in the desert. I knew he was a pilot, and I knew the story was influenced by that. I don't really remember the details of the desert, to be honest.
Okay, well, it's the central passage in one of his books. So he has written non-fiction books. I think he wrote those non-fiction books before even The Little Prince. Sun, Wind and Stars. Let me check this. What is the name of this book? Because I've just finished it, but I'm very bad with titles. Wind, Sand and Stars from 1939. So very close to that. So yeah, the central passage is him being crashed down in the Libyan desert. And it's an amazing story, because it links very much to a story that's earlier in the book of one of his friends getting trapped in the Chilean mountains. And this story of survival as well. And how they're being pushed along by, you know, they're actually very indifferent to their own passing and the demise, but because of their families and friends waiting for them, they have this impulse to keep going. And they're bedeviled by hallucinations and all these different things until suddenly they are rescued in the desert, which is incredible, because I see a nomad on a camel who's kind of half turned to them, and it's like in a movie, you know, where somebody wants to scream out but they're so thirsty that they don't, they physically can't, and then they're kind of hoping that the person turns and sees them, and there's all that agonizing moments, and that's what happens in this story, well, this real life story, and the nomad does turn and see and rescues them, for example. And I think for me, this book is really interesting because it is, I think, maybe an undertold story of aviators in the 20s, especially, and maybe before, you know, just setting up mail routes across the mountains and in South America or Africa, landing in rebel areas and being killed or not coming back. And this sense, you know, there's one passage where he's flying with his co-pilot and they think every light is a runway and it's actually a star. And eventually all these radios across the world from, you know, from across Africa to Paris, they turn on because it's the time to get up in the morning and they tune in and guide the plane home and everything, you know. So there's this kind of this very gentle straddling between accepting the dangers and hearing a pilot's not coming back and accepting it. And also everybody being invested in that pilot coming, you know, a pilot who's in the air coming back and all these kind of radios being tuned into the silence. And kind of like this communion of people kind of shepherding a plane as best as they can, you know, in the wilds of a particular continent. And there's one particular incident where three planes crash in the same area. And he has this beautiful passage where he talks about making a village out of the sand. And for one night, they're a village of men, and one man emitting warmth as light is emitted by a lamp, and these types of passages. So he does have a very particular turn of phrase, very kind of descriptive and artistic, and a man who writes memoirs in the style of these stylized fragments, which is quite interesting. Now, to touch on this idea of him not being a very nice guy, I think he does have a colonial attitude. And as I was saying to you as well, that you know, he talks about this slave whose name is Muhammad, but he keeps calling him by this name that they call every slave. And he talks about how when the slave gets too old, they're released by their masters and they're left to kind of just fall in the sand and sleep until they pass away. Almost like, well, they've earned this right and this is a beautiful thing, I guess he's implying, but really they've outlived their usefulness, no? So they're left to kind of just die and nobody cares about them. And even though he actually kind of buys this slave, and that's so he can help, like, release him, basically. It's not like he wants to keep him. He's just like, well, I'll buy you to get your freedom and then off you go. And there's like a very kind of beautiful passage where this slave, who's called Muhammad, like buys presents for children and the children are very happy, and it's just him searching for some kind of human connection after being lost from his taken from his people and being separated from his people for such a long time. But it's very confusing to get this read on this guy, because is he a guy who obviously doesn't agree with slavery because he helped this guy, but also he has this very maybe nationalistic attitude towards people who dislike the French, like this kind of sense of national feeling amongst the tribesmen or Libyans is somehow childish in his view, for example. So obviously I wouldn't agree with his reading of those things. And then the book ends with his whole personal philosophy, where everybody has to kind of find some meaning in life, but then if it's like Nazism, then that's too far kind of thing, and everybody has competing ideas what gives them meaning, but that's fine as long as it gives you this kind of overarching purpose. Because I think he really believes in the idea that you have to, like, if you just, you know, he criticizes people who maybe take their own life. That's obviously a big topic we won't get into here. But for him, you know, that doesn't make any sense. But if you lose your life, not because you're seeking it, but you accept the risks of doing something big and noble, like going up in a plane that has a faulty engine, because all of them had faulty engines back then that there's something heroic about that. And yeah, he just talks about, I think, you know, so that's his kind of overarching philosophy. And also how I think we should all be living outside cities, because he talks about how we're trapped by roads in straight line, or not straight lines, but curves, you know, and we can be lulled into the sense that, you know, the world is a civilized place. But if you fly in a plane in a straight line, you will see how wild the world is. And also finally, before we go on to the next part of this podcast, he kind of talks about, like from this perspective of the plane, that, you know, he kind of lands, you know, and he sees a girl who's smiling, and he just kind of makes this link with how when you're up in the air, you see the gentle lake that's powered by the deep plates underneath the surface, and how this woman has maybe a boyfriend and they have this world, and there's an inside of that world and outside of that world. There's all these layers of understanding and levels, and nothing is as it appears on the surface, literally and figuratively as well. So the book is kind of full of those different insights, which is just very, you know, interesting that this is the guy who wrote The Little Prince.
No, that's fascinating. I think In a way, a lot of the time, you know, these authors that become famous for a very specific book, then the rest of the work gets lost, and often it's quite interesting for like autobiographical details and other things that sort of go under the radar. So.
Okay, well, no, it's I think it is interesting because, again, when you have a travelogue, you meet people. There's in Chile, again, he's taken to his family's house to eat, and something is like scraping his leg or whatever, like brushing against it, and he finds out it's actually a nest of pythons who nest underneath the table, and they go out during the day to feed and come back at night time to sleep there. So all these kind of just, you know, this jumble of meeting people and this tapestry of people you meet in the back and beyond. So yeah, it's very rich anyway. So those are the books we've been reading, and some rich mixture there, but also not just books we've been seeing, but also photographic exhibitions, which we'll talk about next. We'll talk about all of that next week, because we've already been speaking for half an hour about books, so we'll dedicate a whole episode to the photographs. For me, bye-bye.
Bye.